Princess of Dawn. Prince Aenys accompanied him on Quicksilver. Magor remained on Dragonstone. Aegon had made the Seven Kingdoms one with fire and blood, but after celebrating his 60th name day in 33 AC, he turned instead to brick and mortar. Half of every year was still given over to a royal progress, but now it was Prince Aenys and his wife Lady Alyssa who journeyed from castle to castle, whilst the aging king remained at home, dividing his days between Dragonstone and King's Landing. The fishing village, where Aegon had first landed, had grown into a sprawling, stinking city of 100,000 souls by that time. Only Old Town and Lannisport were larger. Yet in many ways King's Landing was still little more than an army camp that had swollen to grotesque size, dirty, reeking, unplanned, impermanent. And the Aegon Fort, which had spread halfway down Aegon's high hill by that time, was as ugly a castle as any in the Seven Kingdoms, a great confusion of wood and earth and brick that had long outgrown the old log palisades that were its only walls. It was certainly no fit abode for a great king. In 35 AC, Aegon moved with all his court back to Dragonstone, and gave orders that the Aegon Fort be torn down, so that a new castle might be raised in its place. This time, he decreed, he would build in stone. To oversee the design and construction of the new castle, he named the King's Hand, Lord Alan Stokeworth, Sir Osmond Strong had died the previous year, and Queen Visenya. A jape went about the court that King Aegon had given Visenya charge of building the Red Keep, so he would not have to endure her presence on Dragonstone. Aegon the Conqueror died of a stroke on Dragonstone in the 37th year after the conquest. His grandsons, Aegon and Viserys, were with him at his death, in the Chamber of the Painted Table. The king was showing them the details of his conquests. Prince Maegor, in residence at Dragonstone at the time, spoke the eulogy as his father's body was laid upon a funeral pyre in the castle yard. The king was clad in battle armour, his mailed hands folded over the hilt of black fire. Since the days of old Valyria, it had ever been the custom of House Targaryen to burn their dead, rather than consigning their remains to the ground. Vhagar supplied the flames to light the fire. Black fire was burned with the king, but retrieved by Maegor afterward, its blade darker but elsewise unharmed. No common fire can damage Valyrian steel. The dragon was survived by his sister Visenya, his sons Aenys and Maegor, and five grandchildren. Prince Aenys was 30 years of age at his father's death, Prince Maegor 25. Aenys had been at Highgarden on his progress when his father died, but Quicksilver returned him to Dragonstone for the funeral. Afterward he donned his father's iron and ruby crown, and Grand Maester Gowan proclaimed him Aenys of House Targaryen, the first of his name, King of the Andals and the Rhoynar and the First Men, Lord of the Seven Kingdoms and Protector of the Realm. The lords who had come to Dragonstone to bid their king farewell knelt and bowed their heads. When Prince Maegor's turn came, Aenys drew him back to his feet, kissed his cheek, and said, "Brother, you need never kneel to me again. We shall rule this realm together, you and I." Then the king presented his father's sword, Blackfire, to his brother, saying, "You are more fit to bear this blade than me. Wield it in my service, and I shall be content." This bequest would prove to be most unwise, as later events would demonstrate. Since Queen Visenya had previously gifted her son with Dark Sister, Prince Maegor now possessed both of the ancestral Valyrian steel swords of House Targaryen. From this date forward, however, he would wield only Blackfire, whilst Dark Sister hung on the walls of his chambers on Dragonstone. After the funeral rites had been completed, the new king and his entourage sailed to King's Landing, where the Iron Throne still stood amidst mounds of rubble and mud. The old Aegon Fort had been torn down, and pits and tunnels pockmarked the hill where the cellars and foundations of the Red Keep were being dug, but the new castle had not yet begun to rise. Nonetheless, thousands came to cheer King Aenys as he claimed his father's seat for his own. Thereafter, his grace set out for Old Town to receive the blessing of the High Septon. Though he could have made the journey in a few short days on Quicksilver, Aenys preferred to travel by land, accompanied by 300 mounted knights and their retinues. Queen Alyssa rode beside him, together with their 3 eldest children. Princess Rhaena was 14 years of age, a beautiful young girl who stole the heart of every knight who saw her. Prince Aegon was 11, Prince Viserys 8. Their younger siblings, Jaehaerys and Alysanne, were deemed too young for such an arduous journey and remained on Dragonstone. After setting out from King's Landing, the king's party made its way south to Storm's End, then west across the Dornish marches to Old Town, guesting at each castle on the way. His return would be by way of Highgarden, Lannisport, and River Run, it was decreed. All along the route, the small folk appeared by the hundreds and thousands to hail their new king and queen and cheer the young princes and princess. But whilst Aegon and Viserys relished in the cheers of the crowds and the feasts and frolics put on at every castle to entertain the new monarch and his family, Princess Rhaena reverted to her former shyness. At Storm's End, Oris Baratheon's maester went so far as to write, "The princess did not seem to want to be there, nor did she approve of anything she saw or heard. She scarce seemed to eat, would not hunt or hawk, and when pressed to sing, for she is said to have a lovely voice, she refused rudely and returned to her chambers." The princess had been most loath to be parted from her dragon Dreamfire and her latest favourite, Melanie Piper, a red-haired maiden from the Riverlands. It was only when her mother, Queen Alyssa, sent for Lady Melanie to join them on the progress that Rhaena finally put aside her sullenness to join the celebrations. At the Starry Sept, the High Septon anointed Aenys Targaryen as his predecessor had once anointed his father, and presented him with a crown of yellow gold with the faces of the 7 inlaid in jade and pearl. Yet even as Aenys was receiving the blessing of the Father of the Faithful, others were casting doubt on his fitness to sit the Iron Throne. Westeros required a warrior, they whispered to one another, and Maegor was plainly the stronger of the dragon's 2 sons. Foremost amongst the whisperers was the Dowager Queen Visenya Targaryen. "The truth is plain enough," she is reported to have said. "Even Aenys sees it. Why else would he have given Blackfyre to my son? He knows that only Maegor has the strength to rule." The new king's mettle would be tested sooner than anyone could have imagined. The wars of conquest had left scars throughout the realm. Sons now come of age dreamed of avenging long-dead fathers. Knights remembered the days when a man with a sword and a horse and a suit of armour could slash his way to riches and glory. Lords recalled a time when they did not need a king's leave to tax their small folk or kill their enemies. "The chains the dragon forged can yet be broken," the discontented told one another. "We can win our freedoms back. But now is the time to strike, for this new king is weak." The first stirrings of revolt were in the Riverlands, amidst the colossal ruins of Harrenhal. Aegon had granted the castle to Sir Quentin Coherys, his old master at arms. When Lord Coherys died in a fall from his horse in 9 AC, his title passed to his grandson Gargon, a fat and foolish man with an unseemly appetite for young girls who became known as Gargon the Guest. Lord Gargon soon became infamous for turning up at every wedding celebrated within his domains so that he might enjoy the lord's right of the first night. A more unwelcome wedding guest can scarce be imagined. He also made free with the wives and daughters of his own servants. King Aenys was still on his progress, guesting with Lord Tully of Riverrun on his way back to King's Landing, when the father of a maid whom Lord Coherys had honoured opened a postern gate at Harrenhal to an outlaw who styled himself Harren the Red and claimed to be a grandson of Harren the Black. The brigands pulled his lordship from his bed and dragged him to the castle Godswood, where Harren sliced off his genitals and fed them to a dog. A few leal men-at-arms were killed. The rest agreed to join Harren, who declared himself Lord of Harrenhal and King of the Rivers. Not being ironborn, he did not claim the islands. When word reached Riverrun, Lord Tully urged the king to mount Quicksilver and descend on Harrenhal as his father had. But his grace, perhaps mindful of his mother's death in Dorne, instead commanded Tully to summon his banners and lingered at Riverrun as they gathered. Only when 1,000 men were assembled did Aenys march. But when his men reached Harrenhal, they found it empty but for corpses. Harren the Red had put Lord Gargon's servants to the sword and taken his band into the woods. By the time Aenys returned to King's Landing, the news had grown even worse. In the Vale, Lord Ronald Arryn's younger brother, Jonos, had deposed and imprisoned his loyal sibling and declared himself King of Mountain and Vale. In the Iron Islands, another priest-king had walked out of the sea, announcing himself to be Lodos the Twice Drowned, the son of the drowned god, returned at last from visiting his father. And high in the Red Mountains of Dorne, a pretender called the Vulture King appeared and called on all true Dornish men to avenge the evils visited on Dorne by the Targaryens. Though Princess Daria denounced him, swearing that she and all leal Dornish men wanted only peace, thousands flocked to his banners, swarming down from the hills and up out of the sands, through goat tracks in the mountains into the Reach. "This Vulture King is half mad, and his followers are a rabble, undisciplined and unwashed," Lord Harmond Dondarrion wrote to the king. "We can smell them coming 50 leagues away." Not long after, that selfsame rabble stormed and seized his castle of Blackhaven. The Vulture King personally sliced off Dondarrion's nose, before putting Blackhaven to the torch and marching away. King Aenys knew these rebels had to be put down, but seemed unable to decide where to begin. Grand Maester Gawen wrote that the king could not comprehend why this was happening. The small folk loved him, did they not? Jonos Arryn, this new Lodos, the Vulture King, had he wronged them? If they had grievances, why not bring them to him? I would have heard them out. His Grace spoke of sending messengers to the rebels to learn the reasons for their actions. Fearing that King's Landing might not be safe, with Harren the Red alive and near, he sent Queen Alyssa and their younger children to Dragonstone. He commanded his hand, Lord Alan Stokeworth, to take a fleet and army to the Vale to put down Jonos Arryn and restore his brother Ronald to the lordship. But when the ships were about to sail, he countermanded the order, fearing that Stokeworth's departure would leave King's Landing undefended. Instead, he sent the Hand with but a few hundred men to hunt down Harren the Red, and decided he would summon a great council to discuss how best to put down the other rebels. Whilst the king prevaricated, his lords took to the field. Some acted on their own authority, others in concert with the Dowager Queen. In the Vale, Lord Allard Royce of Runestone assembled 20 loyal bannermen and marched against the Eyrie, easily defeating the supporters of the self-styled King of Mountain and Vale. But when they demanded the release of their rightful lord, Jonos Arryn sent his brother to them through the Moon Door. Such was the sad end of Ronald Arryn, who had flown thrice about the giant's lance on Dragonback. The Eyrie was impregnable to any conventional assault, so King Jonos and his die-hard followers spat down defiance at the loyalists and settled in for a siege. Until Prince Smaegor appeared in the sky above, astride Beleriand. The Conqueror's younger son had claimed a dragon at last, none other than the Black Dread, the greatest of them all. Rather than face Beleriand's fires, the Eyrie's garrison seized the pretender and delivered him to Lord Royce, opening the Moon Door once again, and serving Jonos, the kinslayer, as he had served his brother. Surrender saved the pretender's followers from burning, but not from death. After taking possession of the Eyrie, Prince Smaegor executed them to a man. Even the highest-born amongst them were denied the honour of dying by sword. Traitors deserved only a rope, Smaegor decreed, so the captured knights were hanged naked from the walls of the Eyrie, kicking as they strangled slowly. Hubert Arryn, a cousin to the dead brothers, was installed as Lord of the Vale. As he had already sired 6 sons by his lady wife, a Royce of Runestone, the Arryn succession was seen to be secure. In the Iron Islands, Goran Greyjoy, Lord Reaper of Pike, brought King Lodos, second of that name, to a similar swift end, marshalling 100 longships to descend on Oldwick and Greatwick, where the pretender's followers were most numerous, and putting thousands of them to the sword. Afterward he had the head of the priest-king pickled in brine, and sent to King's Landing. King Aenys was so pleased by the gift that he offered Greyjoy any boon he might desire. This proved unwise. Lord Gorran, wishing to prove himself a true son of the drowned god, asked the king for the right to expel all the septons and scepters who had come to the Iron Islands after the conquest to convert the Ironborn to the worship of the Seven. King Aenys had no choice but to agree. The largest and most threatening rebellion remained that of the Vulture King along the Dornish marches. Though Princess Deria continued to issue denunciations from Sunspear, there were many who suspected that she was playing a double game, for she did not take the field against the rebels and was rumoured to be sending them men, money and supplies. Whether that was true or not, hundreds of Dornish knights and several thousand seasoned spearmen had joined the Vulture King's rabble, and the rabble itself had swelled enormously to more than 30,000 men. So large had his host become that the Vulture King made an ill-considered decision and divided his strength. Whilst he marched west against Nightsong and Horn Hill with half the Dornish power, the other half went east to besiege Stonehelm, seat of House Swan, under the command of Lord Walter Will, the son of the Widow Lover. Both hosts met with disaster. Orys Baratheon, known now as Orys Onehand, rode forth from Storm's End one last time to smash the Dornish beneath the walls of Stonehelm. When Walter Will was delivered into his hands, wounded but alive, Lord Orys said, "Your father took my hand. I claim yours as repayment." So saying, he hacked off Lord Walter's sword hand. Then he took his other hand and both his feet as well, calling them his usury. Strange to say, Lord Baratheon died on the march back to Storm's End of the wounds he himself had taken during the battle, but his son Davos always said he died content, smiling at the rotting hands and feet that dangled in his tent like a string of onions. The Vulture King himself fared little better. Unable to capture Nightsong, he abandoned the siege and marched west, only to have Lady Carron sally forth behind him, to join up with a strong force of marchers led by Harmon Dondarrion, the mutilated Lord of Blackhaven. Meanwhile, Lord Samwell Tarly of Horn Hill suddenly appeared athwart the Dornish line of march with several thousand knights and archers. Savage Sam, that lord was called, and so he proved in the bloody battle that ensued, cutting down dozens of Dornish men with his great Valyrian steel blade, Heartsbane. The Vulture King had twice as many men as his three foes combined, but most were untrained and undisciplined, and when faced with armoured knights at front and rear, their ranks shattered. Throwing down their spears and shields, the Dornish broke and ran, making for the distant mountains, but the Marcher Lords rode after them and cut them down in what became known after as the Vulture Hunt. As for the Rebel King himself, the man who called himself the Vulture King was taken alive and tied naked between two posts by Savage Sam Tarly. The singers like to say that he was torn to pieces by the very vultures from whom he took his style, but in truth he perished of thirst and exposure, and the birds did not descend on him until well after he was dead. In later years, several other men would take the title Vulture King, but whether they were of the same blood as the first, no man can say. His death is generally accounted as the end of the Second Dornish War, though that is somewhat of a misnomer, since no Dornish lords ever took the field, and Princess Deria continued to vilify the Vulture King until his end, and took no part in his campaigns. The first of the rebels proved to be the last as well, but Harren the Red was at last brought to bay in a village west of the God's Eye. The outlaw king did not die meekly. In his last fight he slew the king's hand, Lord Alan Stokeworth, before being cut down by Stokeworth's squire, Bernard Brun. A grateful King Aenys conferred knighthood on Brun and rewarded Davos Baratheon, Samwell Tarly, No-Nose Dondarrion, Ellen Carron, Allard Royce, and Goran Greyjoy with gold, offices, and honours. The greatest plaudits he bestowed on his own brother. On his return to King's Landing, Prince Maegor was hailed as a hero. King Aenys embraced him before a cheering throng, and named him Hand of the King. And when two young dragons hatched amidst the fire pits of Dragonstone at the end of that year, it was taken for a sign. but the amity between the dragon's sons did not long endure. It may be that conflict was inevitable, for the two brothers had very different natures. King Aenys loved his wife, his children, and his people, and wished only to be loved in turn. Sword and lance had lost whatever appeal they ever had for him. Instead, his grace dabbled in alchemy, astronomy, and astrology, delighted in music and dance, wore the finest silks, samites, and velvets, and enjoyed the company of maesters, septons, and wits. His brother, Maegor, taller, broader, and fearsomely strong, had no patience for any of that, but lived for war, tourneys, and battle. He was rightly regarded as one of the finest knights in Westeros, though his savagery in the field and his harshness toward defeated foes was oft remarked upon as well. King Aenys sought always to please. When faced with difficulties, he would answer with soft words, whereas Maegor's reply was ever steel and fire. Grand Maester Gawain wrote that Aenys trusted everyone, Maegor no one. The king was easily influenced, Gawain observed, swaying this way and that like a reed in the wind, like as not to heed whichever counsellor last had his ear. Prince Maegor, on the other hand, was rigid as an iron rod, unyielding, unbending. Despite such differences, the sons of the dragon continued to rule together amicably for the best part of 2 years. But in 39 AC, Queen Alyssa gave King Aenys yet another heir, a girl she named Vaela, who sadly died in the cradle not long after. Perhaps it was this continued proof of the queen's fertility that drove Prince Maegor to do what he did. Whatever the reason, the prince shocked the realm and the king both when he suddenly announced that Lady Cerys was barren, and he had therefore taken a second wife in Alice Harroway, daughter of the new Lord of Harrenhal. The wedding was performed on Dragonstone, under the aegis of the Dowager Queen Visenya. As the castle septon refused to officiate, Maegor and his new bride were joined in a Valyrian rite, wed by blood and fire. The marriage took place without the leave, knowledge, or presence of King Aenys. When it became known, the two half-brothers quarrelled bitterly. Nor was his grace alone in his wrath. Manfred Hightower, father of Lady Cerys, made protest to the king, demanding that Lady Alice be put aside. And in the starry sept at Old Town, the High Septum went even further, denouncing Maegor's marriage as sin and fornication, and calling the prince's new bride this whore of Harroway. No true son or daughter of the Seven would ever bow to such, he thundered. Prince Maegor remained defiant. His father had taken both of his sisters to wife, he pointed out. The strictures of the faith might rule lesser men, but not the blood of the dragon. No words of King Aenys could heal the wound his brother's words thus opened, and many pious lords throughout the Seven Kingdoms condemned the marriage, and began to speak openly of Maegor's whore. Vexed and angry, King Aenys gave his brother a choice. Put Alice Harroway aside and return to Lady Cerys, or suffer 5 years of exile. Prince Maegor chose exile. In 40 AC he departed for Pentos, taking Lady Alice, Balerion, and the sword Blackfyre with him. It is said that Aenys requested that his brother return Blackfyre, to which Prince Maegor replied, "Your grace is welcome to try and take her from me." Lady Cerys was left abandoned in King's Landing. To replace his brother as hand, King Aenys turned to Septon Murmison, a pious cleric said to be able to heal the sick by the laying on of hands. The king had him lay hands on Lady Cerys's belly every night in the hopes that his brother might repent his folly if his lawful wife could be made fertile, but the lady soon grew weary of the nightly ritual and departed King's Landing for Old Town, where she rejoined her father in the High Tower. No doubt his grace the king hoped the choice would appease the faith. If so, he was wrong. Septon Murmison could no more heal the realm than he could make Cerys High Tower fecund. The High Septon continued to thunder, and all through the realm the lords in their halls spoke of the king's weakness. "How can he rule the Seven Kingdoms when he cannot even rule his brother?" they said. The king remained oblivious to the discontent in the realm. Peace had returned, his troublesome brother was across the narrow sea, and a great new castle had begun to rise atop Aegon's high hill. Built all in pale red stone, the king's new seat would be larger and more lavish than Dragonstone, with massive walls and barbicans and towers capable of withstanding any enemy. The Red Keep, the people of King's Landing named it. Its building had become the king's obsession. "My descendants shall rule from here for 1,000 years," His Grace declared. Perhaps thinking of those descendants in 41 A.C., Aenys Targaryen made a disastrous blunder and announced his intention to give the hand of his daughter Rhaena in marriage to her brother Aegon, heir to the Iron Throne. The princess was 18, the prince 15. They had been close since childhood, playmates when young. Though Aegon had never claimed a dragon of his own, he had ascended into the skies more than once with his sister on Dreamfire. Lean and handsome and growing taller every year, Aegon was said by many to be the very image of his grandsire at the same age. 3 years of service as a squire had sharpened his prowess with sword and axe, and he was widely regarded as the best young lance in all the realm. Of late, many a young maiden had cast her eye upon the prince, and Aegon was not indifferent to their charms. "If the prince is not wed," Grand Maester Gowan wrote the Citadel, "his grace may soon have a bastard grandchild to contend with." Princess Rhaena had many a suitor as well, but unlike her brother, she gave encouragement to none of them. She preferred to spend her days with her siblings, her dogs and cats, and her newest favourite, Elaine Royce, daughter to the Lord of Runestone. A plump and homely girl, but so cherished that Rhaena sometimes took her flying on the back of Dreamfire, just as she did her brother Aegon. More often, though, Rhaena took to the skies by herself. After her 16th name day, the princess declared herself a woman grown, free to fly where I will. And fly she did. Dreamfire was seen as far away as Harrenhal, Tarth, Runestone, Gulltown. It was whispered, though never proved, that on one of these flights Rhaena surrendered the flower of her maidenhead to a low-born lover. A hedge knight, one story had it. Others named him a singer, a blacksmith's son, a village septon. In light of these tales, some have suggested that Aenys might have felt a need to see his daughter wed as soon as possible. Regardless of the truth of that surmise, at 18 Rhaena was certainly of an age to marry, 3 years older than her mother and father had been when they were wed. Given the traditions and practices of House Targaryen, a match between his two eldest children must have seemed the obvious course to King Aenys. The affection between Rhaena and Aegon was well known, and neither raised any objection to the marriage. Indeed, there is much to suggest that both had been anticipating just such a partnership since they had first played together in the nurseries of Dragonstone and the Aegon Fort. The storm that greeted the king's announcement took them all by surprise, though the warning signs had been plain enough for those with the wit to read them. The faith had condoned, or at the very least, ignored the marriage of the Conqueror and his sisters, but it was not willing to do the same for their grandchildren. From the Starry Sept came a blistering condemnation, denouncing the marriage of brother to sister as an obscenity. Any children born of such a union would be abominations in the sight of gods and men, the father of the faithful proclaimed in a declaration that was read by 10,000 septons throughout the Seven Kingdoms. Aenys Targaryen was infamous for his indecision, yet here, faced with the fury of the faith, he stiffened and grew stubborn. The Dowager Queen Visenya advised him that he had but two choices. He must abandon the marriage and find new matches for his son and daughter, or mount his dragon Quicksilver to fly to Old Town to burn the Starry Sept down around the High Septon's head. King Aenys did neither. Instead, he simply persisted. On the day of the wedding, the streets outside the Sept of Remembrance, built atop the Hill of Rhaenys, and named in honour of the dragon's fallen queen, were lined with warriors' sons in gleaming silver armour, making note of each of the wedding guests as they passed by, afoot, a horse, or in litters. The wiser lords, perhaps expecting that, had stayed away. Those who did come to bear witness saw more than a wedding. At the feast afterward, King Aenys compounded his misjudgment by granting the title Prince of Dragonstone to his presumptive heir, Prince Aegon. A hush fell over the hall at those words, for all present knew that title had hitherto belonged to Prince Maegor. At the high table, Queen Visenya rose and stalked from the hall without the king's leave. That night she mounted Vhagar and returned to Dragonstone, and it is written that when her dragon passed before the moon, that orb turned as red as blood. Aenys Targaryen did not seem to comprehend the extent to which he had roused the realm against him. Eager to win back the favour of the small folk, he decreed that the prince and princess would make a royal progress through the realm, no doubt thinking of the cheers that had greeted him everywhere he went on his own progress. Wiser, perhaps, than her father, Princess Rhaena asked his leave to bring her dragon, Dreamfire, with them, but Aenys forbade it. As Prince Aegon had not yet ridden a dragon, the king feared that the lords and commons might think his son unmanly if they saw his wife on dragonback and him upon a palfrey. The king had grossly misjudged the temper of the kingdom, the piety of his people, and the power of the High Septon's words. From the first day they set out, Aegon and Rhaena and their escort were jeered by crowds of the faithful wherever they went. At Maidenpool, not a single Septon could be found to pronounce a blessing at the feast Lord Mouton threw in their honour. When they reached Harrenhal, Lord Lucas Harroway refused to admit them to his castle unless they agreed to acknowledge his daughter Alice as their uncle's true and lawful wife. Their refusal won them no love from the pious, only a cold, wet night in tents beneath the towering walls of Black Harren's mighty castle. At one village in the Riverlands, several poor fellows went so far as to pelt the royal couple with clods of dirt. Prince Aegon drew his sword to chastise them and had to be restrained by his own knights, for the prince's party was greatly outnumbered. Yet that did not stop Princess Rhaena from riding up to them to say, "You are fearless when facing a girl on a horse, I see. The next time I come, I will be on a dragon. Throw dirt on me then, I pray you." Elsewhere in the realm, matters went from bad to worse. Septon Murmison, the king's hand, was expelled from the faith in punishment for performing the forbidden nuptials, whereupon Aenys himself took quill in hand to write to the High Septon, asking that his High Holiness restore my good Murmison, and explaining the long history of brother-sister marriages in old Valyria. The High Septon's reply was so venomous that his grace went pale when he read it. Far from relenting, the shepherd of the faithful addressed Aenys as King Abomination, declaring him a pretender and a tyrant, with no right to rule the Seven Kingdoms. The faithful were listening. Less than a fortnight later, as Septon Murmison was crossing the city in his litter, a group of poor fellows came swarming from an alley and hacked him to pieces with their axes. The warrior's sons began to fortify the Hill of Rhaenys, turning the Sept of Remembrance into their citadel. With the Red Keep still years away from completion, the king decided that his manse atop Visenya's hill was too vulnerable, and made plans to remove himself to Dragonstone with Queen Alyssa and their younger children. That proved a wise precaution. 3 days before they were to sail, two poor fellows scaled the manse's walls and broke into the king's bedchamber. Only the timely intervention of the king's guard saved Aenys from an ignoble death. His grace was trading Visenya's hill for Visenya herself. On Dragonstone, the Queen Dowager famously greeted him with, "You are a fool and a weakling, nephew. Do you think any man would ever have dared speak so to your father? You have a dragon. Use him. Fly to Old Town and make this starry sept another Harrenhal. Or give me leave and let me roast this pious fool for you." Aenys would not hear of it. Instead, he sent the Queen Dowager to her chambers in Sea Dragon Tower and ordered her to remain there. By the end of 41 AC, much of the realm was deep in the throes of a full-fledged rebellion against House Targaryen. The four false kings who had arisen on the death of Aegon the Conqueror now seemed like so many posturing fools against the threat posed by this new rising, for these rebels believed themselves soldiers of the Seven, fighting a holy war against godless tyranny. Dozens of pious lords throughout the Seven Kingdoms took up the cry, pulling down the king's banners and declaring for the Starry Sept. The warrior's sons seized the gates of King's Landing, giving them control over who might enter and leave the city, and drove the workmen from the unfinished Red Keep. Thousands of poor fellows took to the roads, forcing travellers to declare whether they stood with the gods or the abomination, and remonstrating outside castle gates until their lords came forth to denounce the Targaryen king. In the Westerlands, Prince Aegon and Princess Rhaena were forced to abandon their progress and take shelter in Crakehall Castle. An envoy from the Iron Bank of Braavos, sent to Old Town to treat with Martin Hightower, the new Lord of the High Tower and voice of Old Town, his father Lord Manfred having died a few moons earlier, wrote home to say that the High Septon was the true King of Westeros, in all but name. The coming of the new year found King Aenys still on Dragonstone, sick with fear and indecision. His grace was but 35 years of age, but it was said that he looked like a man of 60, and Grand Maester Gawain reported that he oft took to his bed with loose bowels and stomach cramps. When none of the Grand Maester's cures proved efficacious, the Dowager Queen took charge of the king's care, and Aenys seemed to improve for a time, only to suffer a sudden collapse when word reached him that thousands of poor fellows had surrounded Crake Hall, where his son and daughter were reluctant guests. 3 days later, the king was dead. Like his father, Aenys Targaryen, the first of his name, was given over to the flames in the yard at Dragonstone. His funeral was attended by his sons, Viserys and Jaehaerys, 12 and 7 years of age respectively, and his daughter Alysanne, 5. His widow, Queen Alyssa, sang a dirge for him, and his own beloved Quicksilver set his pyre alight, though it was recorded that the dragons Vermithor and Silverwing added their own fire to hers. Queen Visenya was not present. Within an hour of the king's death, she had mounted Vhagar and flown east across the Narrow Sea. When she returned, Prince Maegor was with her, on Beleriand. Maegor descended on Dragonstone only long enough to claim the crown, not the ornate golden crown Aenys had favoured with its images of the Seven, but the iron crown of their father set with its blood-red rubies. His mother placed it on his head, and the lords and knights gathered their knelt as he proclaimed himself Maegor of House Targaryen, first of his name, King of the Andals, the Rhoynar, and the First Men, Lord of the Seven Kingdoms and Protector of the Realm. Only Grand Maester Gawain dared object. By all the laws of inheritance, laws that the Conqueror himself had affirmed after the conquest, the Iron Throne should pass to King Aenys's son Aegon, the aged maester said. The Iron Throne will go to the man who has the strength to seize it, Maegor replied. Whereupon he decreed the immediate execution of the Grand Maester, taking off Gawain's old grey head himself with a single swing of Blackfyre. Queen Alyssa and her children were not on hand to witness King Maegor's coronation. She had taken them from Dragonstone within hours of her husband's funeral, crossing to her lord father's castle on nearby Driftmark. When told, Maegor gave a shrug, then retired to the chamber of the painted table with a maester to dictate letters to lords great and small throughout the realm. 100 ravens flew within the day. The next day, Maegor flew as well. Mounting Beleriand, he crossed Blackwater Bay to King's Landing, accompanied by the Dowager Queen Visenya upon Vhagar. The return of the dragons set off riots in the city, as hundreds tried to flee, only to find the gates closed and barred. The warrior's sons held the city walls, the pits and piles of what would be the Red Keep and the Hill of Rhaenys, where they had made the Sept of Remembrance their own fortress. The Targaryens raised their standards atop Visenya's hill and called for leal men to gather to them. Thousands did. Visenya Targaryen proclaimed that her son Maegor had come to be their king. A true king, blood of Aegon the Conqueror, who was my brother, my husband, and my love. If any man questions my son's right to the Iron Throne, let him prove his claim with his body. The warrior's sons were not slow to accept her challenge. Down from the Hill of Rhaenys they rode, 700 knights in silvered steel, led by their grand captain, Sir Daemon Morrigan, called Daemon the Devout. "Let us not bandy words," Maegor told him. "Swords will decide this matter." Sir Daemon agreed. The gods would grant victory to the man whose cause was just, he said. "Let each side have 7 champions, as it was done in Andalos of old. Can you find 6 men to stand beside you?" For Aenys had taken the king's guard to Dragonstone, and Maegor stood alone. The king turned to the crowd. "Who will come and stand beside his king?" he called. Many turned away in fear, or pretended that they did not hear, for the prowess of the warrior's sons was known to all. But at last, one man offered himself, no knight, but a simple man-at-arms who called himself Dick Bean. "I've been a king's man since I was a boy," he said. "I mean to die a king's man." Only then did the first knight step forward. "This Bean shames us all," he shouted. "Are there no true knights here, no leal men?" The speaker was Bernard Brun, the squire who had slain Harren the Red and been knighted by King Aenys himself. His scorn drove others to offer their swords. The names of the 4 Maegor chose are writ large in the history of Westeros. Sir Bram of Blackhall, a hedge knight, Sir Rayford Rosby, Sir Guy Lothston, called Guy the Glutton, and Sir Lucifer Massey, Lord of Stonedance. The names of the 7 warriors' sons have likewise come down to us. They were Sir Daemon Morrigan, called Daemon the Devout, grand captain of the warriors' sons, Sir Lyle Bracken, Sir Harris Hawp, called Death's Head Harry, Sir Aegon Ambrose, Sir Dickon Flowers, the Bastard of Beesbury, Sir Willem the Wanderer, and Sir Garibald of the 7 Stars, the Septon Knight. It is written that Daemon the Devout led a prayer, beseeching the warrior to grant strength to their arms. Afterward, the Queen Dowager gave the command to begin, and the issue was joined. Dick Bean died first, cut down by Lyle Bracken mere instants after the combat began. Thereafter, accounts differ markedly. One chronicler says that when the hugely fat Sir Guy the Glutton was cut open, the remains of 40 half-digested pies spilled out. Another claims Sir Garibald of the 7 Stars sang a paean as he fought. Several tell us that Lord Massey hacked off the arm of Harry Hawp. In one account, Death's Head Harry tossed his battle-axe into his other hand and buried it between Lord Massey's eyes. Other chroniclers suggest Sir Harris simply died. Some say the fight went on for hours, others that most of the combatants were down and dying in mere moments. All agree that great deeds were done and mighty blows exchanged, until the end found Maegor Targaryen standing alone against Daemon the Devout and Willem the Wanderer. Both of the warrior's sons were badly wounded, and his grace had Blackfyre in his hand, but even so, it was a near thing. Even as he fell, Sir Willem dealt the king a terrible blow to the head that cracked his helm and left him insensate. Many thought Maegor dead until his mother removed his broken helm. "The king breathes," she said. "The king lives." The victory was his. 7 of the mightiest of the warriors' sons were dead, including their commander, but more than 700 remained, armed and armoured and gathered about the crown of the hill. Queen Visenya commanded her son be taken to the maesters. As the litter-bearers bore him down the hill, the swords of the faith dropped to their knees in submission. The Dowager Queen ordered them to return their fortified sept atop the Hill of Rhaenys. For 27 days, Maegor Targaryen lingered at the point of death, whilst maesters treated him with potions and poultices and septons prayed above his bed. In the sept of remembrance, the warrior's sons prayed as well and argued about their course. Some felt the order had no choice but to accept Maegor as king, since the gods had blessed him with victory. Others insisted that they were bound by oath to obey the High Septon and fight on. The king's guard arrived from Dragonstone in the nonce. At the behest of the Dowager Queen, they took command of the thousands of Targaryen loyalists in the city and surrounded the Hill of Rhaenys. On Driftmark, the widowed Queen Alyssa proclaimed her own son Aegon the true king, but few heeded her call. The young prince, just shy of manhood, remained at Crake Hall half a realm away, trapped in a castle surrounded by poor fellows and pious peasants, most of whom considered him an abomination. In the citadel of Old Town, the archmaesters met in conclave to debate the succession and choose a new grand maester. Thousands of poor fellows streamed toward King's Landing. Those from the west followed the hedge knight Sir Horace Hill, those from the south a gigantic axeman called Wat the Hewer. When the ragged bands encamped about Crake Hall left to join their fellows on the march, Prince Aegon and Princess Rhaena were finally able to depart. Abandoning their royal progress, they made their way to Casterly Rock, where Lord Lyman Lannister offered them his protection. It was his wife, Lady Jocasta, who first discerned that Princess Rhaena was with child, Lord Lyman's maester tells us. On the 28th day after the Trial of Seven, a ship arrived from Pentos upon the evening tide, carrying 2 women and 600 sellswords. Alice of House Harroway, Maegor Targaryen's second wife, had returned to Westeros, but not alone. With her sailed another woman, a pale, raven-haired beauty known only as Tyana of the Tower. Some said the woman was Maegor's concubine. Others named her Lady Alice's paramour. The natural daughter of a Pentoshi magister, Tyana was a tavern dancer who had risen to be a courtesan. She was rumored to be a poisoner and sorceress as well. Many queer tales were told about her, yet as soon as she arrived, Queen Visenya dismissed her son's maesters and septons and gave Maegor over to Tyana's care. The next morning, the king awoke, rising with the sun. When Maegor appeared on the walls of the Red Keep, standing between Alice Harroway and Tyana of Pentos, the crowds cheered wildly, and the city erupted in celebration. But the revels died away when Maegor mounted Balerion and descended upon the Hill of Rhaenys, where 700 of the warrior's sons were at their morning prayers in the fortified sept. As Dragonfire set the building aflame, archers and spearmen waited outside for those who came bursting through the doors. It was said the screams of the burning men could be heard throughout the city, and a pall of smoke lingered over King's Landing for days. Thus did the cream of the warrior's sons meet their fiery end. Though other chapters remained in Old Town, Lannisport, Gulltown, and Stony Sept, the Order would never again approach its former strength. King Maegor's war against the Faith Militant had just begun, however. It would continue for the remainder of his reign. The king's first act upon ascending the Iron Throne was to command the poor fellows swarming toward the city to lay down their weapons, under penalty of proscription and death. When his decree had no effect, his grace commanded all leal lords to take the field and disperse the faith's ragged hordes by force. In response, the High Septon in Old Town called upon true and pious children of the gods to take up arms in defence of the faith and put an end to the reign of dragons and monsters and abominations. Battle was joined first in the Reach at the town of Stonebridge. There, 9,000 poor fellows, under Wat the Hewer, found themselves caught between 6 lordly hosts as they attempted to cross the Mander. With half his men north of the river and half on the south, Wat's army was cut to pieces. His untrained and undisciplined followers, clad in boiled leather, rough spun, and scraps of rusted steel, and armed largely with woodsmen's axes, sharpened sticks, and farm implements, proved utterly unable to stand against the charge of armoured knights on heavy horses. So grievous was the slaughter that the Mander ran red for 20 leagues, and thereafter the town and castle where the battle had been fought became known as Bitterbridge. Wat himself was taken alive, though not before slaying 6 knights, amongst them Lord Meadows of Grassy Vale, commander of the king's host. The giant was delivered to King's Landing in chains. By then, Sir Horace Hill had reached the Great Fork of the Blackwater with an even larger host, close on 13,000 poor fellows, their ranks stiffened by the addition of 200 mounted warriors' sons from Stony Sept, and the household knights and feudal levies of 12 rebel lords from the Westerlands and Riverlands. Lord Rupert Folwell, famed as the Fighting Fool, led the ranks of the pious who had answered the High Septon's call. With him rode Sir Lionel Lorch, Sir Alan Terrick, Lord Christopher Wayne, Lord John Leicester, and many other puissant knights. The army of the faithful numbered 20,000 men. King Magor's army was of like size, however, and his grace had almost twice as much armoured horse, as well as a large contingent of longbowmen, and the king himself riding Balerion. Even so, the battle proved a savage struggle. The Fighting Fool slew two knights of the king's guard before he himself was cut down by the Lord of Maidenpool. Big John Hogg, fighting for the king, was blinded by a sword slash early in the battle, yet rallied his men and led a charge that broke through the lines of the faithful and put the poor fellows to flight. A rainstorm dampened Balerion's fires but could not quench them entirely, and amidst smoke and screams, King Magor descended again and again to serve his foes with flame. By nightfall, victory was his, as the remaining poor fellows threw down their axes and streamed away in all directions. Triumphant, Magor returned to King's Landing to seat himself once more upon the Iron Throne. When what the hewer was delivered to him, chained yet still defiant, Magor took off his limbs with the giant's own axe, but commanded his maesters to keep the man alive, so he might attend my wedding. Then his grace announced his intent to take Tyana of Pentos as his third wife. Though it was whispered that his mother, the Queen Dowager, had no love for the Pentoshi sorceress, only Grand Maester Miros dared speak against her openly. "Your one true wife awaits you in the High Tower," Miros said. The king heard him out in silence, then descended from the throne, drew Blackfyre, and slew him where he stood. Maegor Targaryen and Tyana of the Tower were wed atop the Hill of Rhaenys, amidst the ashes and bones of the warrior's sons who had died there. It was said that Magor had to put a dozen septons to death before he found one willing to perform the ceremony. Wat the Hewer, limbless, was kept alive to witness the marriage. King Aenys's widow, Queen Alyssa, was present as well, with her younger sons Viserys and Jaehaerys, and her daughter Alysanne. A visit from the Dowager Queen and Vhagar had persuaded her to leave her sanctuary on Driftmark and return to court, where Alyssa and her brothers and cousins of House Valerian did homage to Magor as the true king. The widowed queen was even compelled to join the other ladies of the court in disrobing his grace and escorting him to the nuptial chamber to consummate his marriage, a bedding ceremony presided over by the king's second wife, Alice Harroway. That task done, Alyssa and the other ladies took their leave of the royal bedchamber, but Alice remained, joining the king and his newest wife in a night of carnal lust. Across the realm in Old Town, the High Septon was loud in his denunciations of the abomination and his whores, whilst the king's first wife, Cerise of House Hightower, continued to insist that she was Maegor's only lawful queen. And in the Westerlands, Aegon Targaryen, Prince of Dragonstone, and his wife, Princess Rhaena, remained defiant as well. All through the turmoil of Maegor's ascension, King Aenys's son and the princess, his wife, had remained at Casterly Rock, where Rhaena grew great with child. Most of the knights and young lordlings who had set out with them on their ill-fated progress had abandoned them, rushing off to King's Landing to bend their knees to Maegor. Even Rhaena's handmaids and companions had found excuses to absent themselves, save for her friend Alain Royce and her former favourite, Melanie Piper, who arrived at Lannisport with her brothers to swear the loyalty of their house. All his life, Prince Aegon had been considered the heir presumptive to the Iron Throne, but now, suddenly, he found himself reviled by the pious and abandoned by many he had thought to be his leal friends. Magor's supporters, who seemed more numerous every day, were not shy in saying that Aegon was his father's son, suggesting that they saw in him the same weakness that had brought down King Aenys. Aegon had never ridden a dragon, they pointed out, whereas Magor had claimed Balerion, and the prince's own bride, Princess Rhaena, had been flying Dreamfire since the age of 12. Queen Alyssa's attendance at Magor's wedding was trumpeted as proof that Aegon's own mother had abandoned his cause. Though Lyman Lannister, Lord of Casterly Rock, stood firm when Maegor demanded that Aegon and his sister be returned to King's Landing, in chains if need be, even he would not go so far as to pledge his sword to the youth who now found himself being called the Pretender and Aegon the Uncrowned. And thus it was there at Casterly Rock that Princess Rhaena gave birth to Aegon's daughters, twins they named Arya and Rhaela. From the Starry Sept came another blistering proclamation. These children, too, were abominations, the High Septon proclaimed, fruits of lust and incest, accursed of the gods. The maester at Casterly Rock, who helped deliver the children, tells us that afterward Princess Rhaena begged the prince, her husband, to take them all across the narrow sea to Tyrush, or Myr, or Volantis, anywhere beyond their uncle's reach, for I would gladly give up my own life to make you king, but I will not put our girls at risk. But her words fell on stony ears, and her tears were shed in vain, for Prince Aegon was determined to claim his birthright. The dawn of the year 43 AC found King Maegor in King's Landing, where he had taken personal charge of the construction of the Red Keep. Much of the finished work was now undone or changed. New builders and workmen were brought in, and secret passages and tunnels crept through the depths of Aegon's high hill. As the red stone towers rose, the king commanded the building of a castle within the castle, a fortified redoubt surrounded by a dry moat that would soon be known to all as Maegor's Holdfast. In that same year, Maegor made Lord Lucas Harroway, father of his wife, Queen Alice, his new hand. But it was not the hand who had the king's ear. His grace might rule the seven kingdoms, men whispered, but he himself was ruled by the three queens, his mother, Queen Visenya, his paramour, Queen Alice, and the Pentoshi witch, Queen Tyana. The Mistress of Whispers, Tyana was called, and the King's Raven for her black hair. She spoke with rats and spiders, it was said, and all the vermin of King's Landing came to her by night to tell tales of any fool rash enough to speak against the king. Meanwhile, thousands of poor fellows still haunted the roads and wild places of the Reach, the Trident, and the Vale. Though they would never again assemble in large numbers to face the king in open battle, the stars fought on in smaller ways, falling upon travellers and swarming over towns, villages and poorly defended castles, slaying the king's loyalists wherever they found them. Sir Horace Hill had escaped the battle at Great Fork, but defeat and flight had tarnished him, and his followers were few. The new leaders of the poor fellows were men like Ragged Silas, Septon Moon, and Dennis the Lame, hardly distinguishable from outlaws. One of their most vicious captains was a woman called Poxy Jane Poor, whose savage followers made the woods between King's Landing and Storm's End all but impassable to honest travellers. Meanwhile, the warrior's sons had chosen a new grand captain in the person of Sir Geoffrey Doggett, the Red Dog of the Hills, who was determined to restore the order to its former glory. When Sir Geoffrey set out from Lannisport to seek the blessing of the High Septon, 100 men rode with him. By the time he arrived in Old Town, so many knights and squires and free riders had joined him that his numbers had swollen to 2,000. Elsewhere in the realm, other restless lords and men of faith were gathering men as well, and plotting ways to bring the dragons down. None of this had gone unnoticed. Ravens flew to every corner of the realm, summoning lords and landed knights of doubtful loyalty to King's Landing to bend the knee, swear homage, and deliver a son or daughter as a hostage for their obedience. The Stars and Swords were outlawed. Membership in either order would henceforth be punishable by death. The High Septon was commanded to deliver himself to the Red Keep, to stand trial for high treason. His High Holiness responded from the Starry Sept, commanding the king to present himself in Old Town to beg the forgiveness of the gods for his sins and cruelties. Many of the faithful echoed his defiance. Some pious lords did travel to King's Landing to do homage and present hostages, but more did not, trusting to their numbers and the strength of their castles to keep them safe. King Maegor let the poisons fester for almost half a year, so engrossed was he in the building of his Red Keep. It was his mother who struck first. The Dowager Queen mounted Vhagar and brought fire and blood to the Riverlands as once she had to Dorne. In a single night, the seats of